My name is Marion Hunt, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Dr. Helen Nash in the King Room on April 20th, 1999. We're going to start with a discussion of Dr. Nash's childhood in Atlanta, where she was born August 8th, 1921. And I'd like to ask Dr. Nash something about growing up in Atlanta and where she went to school and her parents.
Okay. Well, growing up in Atlanta, if your parents were educated or had income, was relatively easy for black children. My father had come back from the World War I and had a successful practice on Auburn Avenue in what is called a Herndon building. I can remember going down to visit him.
From what age did you go to the office? He would take you downtown?
Whenever I was downtown with my mother, we'd always stop by the office to get a ride home.
So you knew that he had a successful practice?
I knew that he had a successful practice all my life. And then at home, in the mornings and on weekends when patients called, and we lived on the edge of town, when patients called who lived further out, he would go
to their homes.
To make house calls.
Did you ever go with him to make a house call?
We always wanted to go because we wanted to ride, and he didn't want us to go for fear the car would break down. And I can remember the time the car did break down, but it broke down because the battery dropped out.
What did he do then?
He had to carry Harriet, and Catherine and I ran along behind him, and he was just walking and fussing at us.
To the patient's house or to the
guest? No, we had made it there and we're on our way back.
Oh, my God.
And so that was reason not to ever go with him again when he went out in the country on a house call.
But you knew that your father was a very successful doctor from the time you were a little girl, because he opened his practice in 1910 on Auburn Avenue. So by the time you were born in 1921, he had been in practice 9 years with 2 years out for the war, because
he
went over to France.
Right, he was successful.
And you were the third of six children, uh-huh. And your parents' first child died. That was
first child died Marie. From what when I came to St. Louis and interviewed Dr. Hartman so I could be on the staff at Children's Hospital. He said, I know where I was the day you were born. I was up in the lab trying to decide how to stop infants who are having diarrhea from getting dehydrated and into electrolyte imbalance. He was making
Hartman's solution. And did your sister die of dehydration?
She died of dehydration.
Of a childhood disease, of the kind of
gastroenteritis.
Okay, and the death of the oldest child affected your parents deeply, you said.
Yes, it was for several reasons. She had been born while my father was in France in World War I, and my mother had been left a young bride in Atlanta. She was living with her parents, and they did not know at the time the baby was born whether or not he was alive.
So this baby was a lifeline.
She was sort of a lifeline. And when he came home, of course, he brought a lot of things from France.
For the baby?
French lace dresses and stuff like that. We always started, we would get Nana to take them out and let us see them. These are clothes no one ever wore because she died.
And she never took them out?
She was 22 months old. She would take them out when she wanted to talk about her.
But nobody ever wore those clothes.
Yeah, she would take the infant's pictures in the French lace dress.
Right.
And I think home was the last one.
To wear them.
To wear the dress.
And so when you were growing up, the whole time you were growing up, you knew there was this little lost sister.
There was this baby they had lost, and baby they never really got over the death.
Even with five healthy children.
Well, the reason we knew she didn't get over the death is if you coughed, you went to the doctor. She was afraid you would die.
She was hypervigilant, very vigilant.
She was very afraid.
So your mother was very protective of you.
Of all of you.
Mm-hmm. And so then when you got up to be the age of and you got through kindergarten, elementary school at Oglethorpe and got ready to go to Spelman, you were already thinking about medical school when you were a teenager?
when I was a teenager, I made a career book, and I had the cover was a picture of a man doing camera work with the hood and the sticks of the tripod sticking out, a picture of a doctor listening to someone. And I've forgotten what the other, I had three career choices.
But you did become a photographer as well as a doctor.
I became a photographer of sorts. Right.
So, and when it came time for medical school, your grandfather, Antoine Graves.
Well, he was dying. He had kidney failure. And of course, he was way up in his near his 90s, so it wasn't an unusual death. I went to see him the day before he died. They said, come to see Papa. Papa's dying. And I went, and they were standing around the room with his three daughters. And he said, which one is that? And they said, is that the one who wants to go to med school? And they said, yes. And he said, sell a house and send her.
And that's how you went with
his... He was leaving property all over Atlanta. And they would never think of disobeying Papa.
And so your mother...
sold the house.
And your father was worried about your going because you were so...
I was small and it would be too hard. I was too little. And
you weighed 92 pounds and you were 5'1" or whatever and looked frail. I've seen pictures. You look frail in the pictures.
But I was never sick.
No, you were tough even back then. So you went off to medical school in 1930, what would
that? I finished college in 42, didn't I? Yes.
Graduated from Spelman. And did you ever know a black woman physician?
Yes, I was born in one's hospital. In fact, they had pictures of it in one of the WashU magazines one year. Her name was Georgia Dwelly, and she had a hospital in Atlanta.
D-W-E-L-L-Y.
E.
E. Dwelly. Georgia Dwelly.
And everyone respected her and liked her, but she ran a hospital so that you didn't have to go to the city hospital to have a baby.
And of course the hospitals were segregated in
very
Atlanta.
Segregated.
And when did you first become aware of racism? Because you had a very protective family, a very prosperous family, but still you must have known or sensed something about racism even as a child, do you think?
Yes, I got... the streetcar that stopped in front of Oglethorpe, which was our grade school, ran across Atlanta through downtown Atlanta to the black neighborhood on Auburn Avenue. My grandmother lived on Auburn Avenue. I don't know who was sick or why, but Catherine and Harriet and I were catching the streetcar at Oglethorpe and riding across town to Auburn Avenue and Boulevard. And my grandmother and her daughter would be there to meet us. They knew what time we were going to catch the streetcar. And this time, we got off the back, and they had a fit. What are you doing back there? Oh, it's wonderful. He let us sit back in the conductor's seat, and he let us drive.
Oh, and so you liked that.
But what had happened is we had been sitting up on the front talking to him. And when we got down to the Union to Terminal Station in Atlanta, there was a stop. A woman got on, and she raised a lot of cane.
A white woman.
About three little black girls sitting up front, and she wanted us arrested. And he didn't want to have us arrested,
so he
said, wait, let me take care of it. And he said, wouldn't you like to sit back here where you can see where we have
drive.
Been?
Oh, isn't
and you can drive. And so back we went.
And you never, I mean, you realized
we
something.
Didn't know what was wrong, but
right.
When we told them, they had a fit. And we never got on the streetcar again for years.
That is amazing.
So that was Catherine, Harriet, and myself.
The three little girls.
Three little girls.
So then when you went off to Meharry, that would have been in 1942.
I left home in 1942.
And the war was on. World War II was on, and when you got there, how big was your class at Meharry?
Every class had 65.
And how many women would be in your class?
There were four of us in our class.
So that was a small, close-knit, where you did the four of you stick together, or did you have a special friend?
No, we didn't stick together. My special friend is the one who died Christmas time.
What was her name?
Was Margaret Williams Reed.
And she was a year ahead of you.
She was a year ahead of me. And her father, my father, knew each other. He practiced in Savannah, Georgia. My father practiced in Atlanta, Georgia.
And where did you live? Did they have dormitories or an apartment? Or?
Well, you lived with your... You boarded. The citizens of Nashville made a living boarding medical students because there was no dormitory. And I lived with my mother's friends. You know, you could not go off and just... Like you can now come to a city and find yourself a place.
But your parents wanted to make sure...
You could not do that. They'd have to protect you even further by... Live with Miss So-and-so, who is their friend and who knows you and will help take care of you.
Right. So they knew you were safe.
So you would be safe. I lived with some people on Scoville Street that my mother's friends had picked out. And then my friend, whom I start living with at the end of my freshman year, was living at our friend's house, Mrs. Johnson's house. My mother had tried to get a room for me at Mrs. Johnson's. She owned the movie theater, the funeral home, and something else.
So your mother's apron strings were protecting you even
all the way
through medical school.
Anyway, Margaret and her husband saw me one morning on the way to breakfast and said, will you like to live with Margaret next year? He was leaving to come out here to do an internship.
So you moved in with Margaret?
And I said, no, I don't. I have a good room. I don't need to move. And when I got home that night, the woman told me her daughter was going to have a baby and they wanted my room.
So you did move.
I had to fly back and catch her before she got someone else.
So Margaret and you roomed together for 2 years?
So Margaret and I roomed together and formed a lifetime friendship. She had a stroke and died Christmas time.
But you were her loyal friend for all those years?
All those years we were friends. We traveled together. We went around the world together.
And when you were students together, did you feel as black women that you got different treatment than the young men at Meharry? Did the professors treat?
Oh yes, that was no problem. That was no question, and you had to just know your stuff. You just never be unable to answer a question. Just study and answer, be able to answer questions.
And know? Margaret and you were both good students, I'm
sure. Yeah, we were.
So when you
we were ready, you might say.
They didn't ever catch you without an answer, I'm sure.
Never without an answer.
So when it came time for your internship, how did you decide to come to Homer G?
Well, everybody came to Homer G. It was one of the best places. They took the largest number of interns, and you could be sure of getting a residency.
And
I wanted to do pediatrics.
You knew that from had you decided pediatrics while you were in medical school?
Yes, yeah. I had.
You just had a feeling that was where...
That was what I wanted to do. And so the major thing was to be get accepted here.
And it was competitive. It was very competitive.
My first service was pediatrics, and I met Dr. Park White.
Your very first year in St. Louis, you met PJ.
Right.
Right. And did you and he hit it off from the start?
We hit it off from the start, and he knew I wanted the pediatric residency the next year. And I got it.
So he was your mentor, really, from the time you came.
From the beginning, right.
And you knew that he was a white man with an unusual passion for racial justice at the time.
Right, though we used to catch him in what we call prejudices. But they weren't anything serious.
But when you came to St. Louis, it was a very segregated city, was it?
Very, very segregated. And in fact, I could have a quarter... I've forgotten how much the fare was, but I could catch the Sarah streetcar at St. Ferdinand and Sarah and ride out to the garden and get off and walk all through the garden and then come back and get back on the Sarah streetcar and come back to Home Phillips. That was one of the first things I learned to do.
Was to ride the streetcar all the way to the garden.
To the botanical garden. It was so beautiful. And you know now it is even more beautiful.
Yes. So the segregation or the racism of St. Louis, you didn't feel it in the garden. But if you were to go shopping or to you want to use the bathroom or eat lunch.
You'd feel it, but you know you wouldn't. You'd fix it so you didn't have to. You'd
put
eat
up
lunch
with it
before you went. And
so, where did you live when you came to St. Louis? Did you live?
I lived
right
in the nursing home at Home of Hope's Hospital.
The first year.
The first 5 or 6 years.
And then tell me, describe to me what the conditions on the pediatric ward were for the babies. How were
well, there hadn't been anybody there who really cared about the pediatric ward. And as the nurse, when I got to be the resident in charge, I started tightening up stuff. And the nurse, I will never forget her, told the staff, the nursing staff was upset. I want to bathe every morning before I make rounds. I want the nurse's notes, and I want a nurse to come along with us on rounds so we know what had happened. And they were very distressed because they hadn't had to do all this work.
So you made them work harder.
They had to work harder, and they complained to her, and she said, just wait until I see what can be done about her.
We can get rid of her, but they never did.
Well, I got rid of her. So.
Now, how long did it take for you to become chief resident? First, you did a rotating internship.
You did
internship,
a rotating internship, then you did a
second,
senior internship.
And then the third year, you became chief resident.
No. The third year, your fourth year, you became chief resident.
So that would have been in 1946, you were chief resident.
Somewhere in there. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. White was very much behind you and helped
all
you.
All the way.
And what year did you pass your boards for pediatrics? The pediatric boards. Was that later?
See, I can't remember. I have it at...
Oh, we can find that out at home.
I'll give it to you.
Okay. But
I had promised myself if I failed I wouldn't come back.
And so I want to have the story on tape about your younger brother Homer, who was also a physician, came up to do a pediatric internship, and he was four years behind you?
4 or 5 years behind. But it was maybe longer than that because he was married and had a baby and had been to World War
II. So he...
And when he came here, of course he got the internship. I introduced him to Dr. White, and there wasn't any problem. When he decided he would like to do the internship here,
his big sister had smoothed the path.
I had smoothed the path. And he said that to me. He said, you know, everywhere you had been, it was just open sesame because you had done so well. And I was glad to hear that. But what made me very angry was when I got ready to take the board, I saw Dr. Hartman on the ward one morning, and I told him I was taking the board in April. And he said, well, study hard.
Good luck.
And, of course, I studied hard, and, of course, I passed. I wouldn't have come back to St. Louis if I hadn't passed. And when Homer went to told him he was going to take the pediatric board, I found they had a study group here. They had...
All the boys.
All the boys, the old boys, had all the exam questions from years past. And they had regular study group meetings. I was never invited to them.
So when you passed on your own studying.
I said, well, it's
your grade.
It's my grade. I passed, and I passed without any help.
And I'd like to ask you also a little bit about the gender bias at Homer Phillips, because you told me a long time ago that you had trouble with some of the black male physicians who did not... Maybe because you were this cute little 5 foot, 92 pound doctor, could not listen or hear you when you said this baby is sick. And I wonder if you could tell me the story about the sick baby. And
well, you would call and ask for a consult. And if the resident wasn't busy, he would come, he would say, are you sure? Or get another x-ray, or get another blood count, or get another... They would always give you some busy work to do, and you'd have to call and say, really need to come, this baby has appendicitis.
And you had a surgeon who didn't want to be bothered and said...
Have a male surgeon who wouldn't want to be bothered, or a male doctor who was just prejudiced against women doctors and saying, we didn't know anything. How could I know when a baby had appendicitis?
So when he came back in the morning and he said, "Where's that baby?"
I said, "She's in the morgue. She
and
died."
That must have made an impression on him. So you were not necessarily very popular at Homer Phillips because you demanded, you made the nurses work harder.
I was not very popular, right.
And then tell me the story about ice cream once a year at Homer Phillips. I like that story. Cause
we had, we never had ice cream. I went to the diet kitchen and I asked the dietitian who had gotten to be a friend of mine, "Why we never had ice cream and we never had bananas? What
two things that babies love?" Yeah.
Ice cream is an American national food, and
right,
bananas are the most easily digested food on the market. And she said, "I'll show you the grocery list that came from downtown." And ice cream and bananas were marked by City Hospital only.
Which was the White Hospital.
Which was the White Hospital.
And we're talking about a time when there was no air, Homer Phillips was not air conditioned.
Nothing.
The babies were lying in hot.
You had to beg for a fan.
Right.
Anyway.
You got the ice cream.
I went to the medical director and to the superintendent, who was McKnight.
And was the medical director Sinkler?
Mm-hmm. The medical director was Dr. Sinkler. I said, "Can you imagine that children on my ward can't have ice cream because they're black and can't have bananas because they're
outrageous.
Black?"
Outrageous. So you
and
were...
And he would say, "Miss Helen, here you go again." I said, "You have to have ice cream and bananas if you are little."
Right.
You just have to have.
But it's interesting that Dr. White, even with his concern...
He didn't know it.
Right.
He didn't know it anyway.
So you were the one who changed the diet as far
well,
as...
Well, I was there when the diets came up. I said,
right,
"We never have ice cream on this floor. What's wrong?"
Right.
And the dietitian showed me. And so we started having... They said, "Well, Homer Phillips can have ice cream one week and City Hospital will get it the next
week." So they alternate.
And then the people at City Hospital began to fuss. They had been having it every day.
Right.
Know? And so they decided to alternate it. And then they caused so much ruckus that they just said, "Everybody have ice cream every day.
All the time.
All you want.
All right.
Just
so
forget it."
So that settled it.
That settled it. The children had ice
cream.
Wonderful. We also got bananas the same way.
That's great. So that was a real positive.
It was a crazy thing to have
to
do. You know?
So racism, as you once told me, was a very intricate web that extended to trivial things that you wouldn't even think that, you know, bananas and ice cream.
Color off TP.
That's crazy. Now, the other thing you told me one time was about the death rate at Homer Phillips from infectious diarrhea.
Well, the infant mortality rate, morbidity and mortality rates, were very high for infants all over the country. And the premature infants at Homer Phillips, because there was no set up premature unit at the time, had a death rate above 80%, and there were quite a large number of them born every month.
Did they even have incubators or any?
No, they didn't have incubators.
Isolates?
Didn't have any, isolates hadn't been designed.
So so where would they put a premature baby?
In a crib in the room next to a sick child. They didn't.
They didn't even segregate them by
they
illness.
They didn't know to segregate them.
Because I remember a picture that you showed me with a whole row of them lined up like little cigars in a box.
Well, those were the crib things. They used to roll them out on the ward.
I see.
It was a big thing, and then every little babies would be in there, and they rolled that to the maternity ward, and the...
So these were healthy babies then?
Those were healthy babies.
But there was a scandal at Homer Phillips because diarrhea swept through the ward, or...
One year swept through, and we lost 30 babies. And
they
said, what do you need? You know, I've been fussing about the death rate.
Right.
Fussing about we don't have this, we don't have enough fluids, we don't have...
And finally, when disaster struck,
you got everything.
Then you got everything.
We got Gordon Armstrong incubators.
And that would have been in 1948 or 9, around then?
It had to be around.
I'm sure that if I go to the Post-Dispatch, I can find, I bet it made the newspapers, that there was this big epidemic at Homer Phillips.
I don't remember.
Well, in this article I wrote, we talked about the segregation of Children's Hospital and how... they had a separate building called the Butler Ward for black children.
Just tore it down.
That's right. They just tore it down. And this was, when I wrote my thesis, I found out that there were some women on the board of managers who did want black children to have care in the general hospital, but there were other women who prevailed who said, no, we'll build a separate ward.
So they had Butler Ward.
Right. And then
when the big epidemic
of polio
came in 45, I think.
47 is what Dr. White said. But anyway, that's when they desegregated because
that was the only place that was really isolatable.
Right. So they used the segregated ward for the sick, for the polio
for
children.
For the polio children, and black infants and children were put all around the hospital, depending on their illness.
Right. And then you opened your practice, you finished up at Homer Phillips, and when did you open your first office, and where was it located? Can you remember that?
Mm-hmm. My first office was at Van Deventer and Finney.
Van Deventer, and was that a rough neighborhood at the time, or was
no,
it?
No,
okay.
it was nice. The black business neighborhood.
Like,
telephone office was across the street.
So it was like Auburn Avenue. It was a prosperous.
It was not as prosperous as Auburn Avenue, but there were several black businesses along the street.
And what did people say when you said, I'm going to open a solo practice?
Nobody wants a woman doctor.
And a black...
I was trying to borrow money. I went to Bishop Scarlett.
You did?
And he told me, child, go back in the hospital. Nobody wants a woman doctor.
Bishop William Scarlett, the great liberal, the friend of Eleanor Roosevelt, told you to go back to the hospital.
Go back in the hospital.
So
nobody wants a woman doctor. I thanked him and left.
He didn't say nobody wants a black doctor. He said nobody wants a woman doctor.
Right.
So gender was really the issue with that.
Gender was the issue.
So how did you get the money to start your practice? I mean, where
between myself and my father.
And your father. Mm-hmm. You opened up.
And he kept saying, you don't need a lot of things. What you do if you see a patient in your office and you need something you don't have, give him an appointment for the next day, go down to Allo's, get it, and charge it to me, and see the patient the next day.
So he gave you
some pointers.
He told
me how to do it.
And so your practice flourished.
My practice boomed.
And how did people just, you hung out a shingle, people knew
I mailed notices to all the black doctors in the Mound City Medical Forum. And I mailed notices to those at Children's Hospital who knew me. And I mailed notices to all my mother's friends.
And it said, Helen E. Nash, M.D. announces the opening of her practice on Van Deventer and Finney.
Right.
General Pediatrics.
1048 A North Van Deventer.
1048 A North. We'll have to ride by there and see.
Right.
And so by that time you had built up, you were known in St. Louis.
I had been doing what a lot of people do. I would put my stethoscope and otoscope in a bag, and I would make house calls that last year, and I had quite a few patients.
So you had built up a loyalty.
In fact, some of the nicest patients were from the Walnut Park area, which is at Grand and La Cleve, and that was not paved, and I used to go down there.
And they followed you back to your practice
they
when you opened
They followed me
back
to my practice, and I see the children and grandchildren still.
That's wonderful. So you opened in 1950 your practice, would you say?
I can't remember the exact year, but I
can
tell you when we get home.
Okay. So you opened your practice, and then
it
took off, and you were making good money within a year.
By Christmas. My father said, I went home the day before I was supposed to open it and said, I can't do it, I don't have any money, and so and so and so. So he gave me $100 and said, go back and do it, you can do it.
So he became, at the beginning you said he worried that you were too frail, but then he could see that you were going to be
a great supporter.
A big success.
So I came back with my little $100 and put it in the bank, and I still see the very first patient who came to the office that day, and he knows he was my first patient.
What was his name?
In a minute.
And what was wrong with him? I bet you remember that.
Constipation.
Oh, that's a classic. And what was your remedy?
My remedy was to feed him some fruit and things, you know.
And
I had given him medicine for constipation. I never gave medicine for constipation.
That loosened him right up.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to ask you, now that you're practice was off the ground, how you how it was that you became one of the first four doctors to join the attending staff, and who contacted you about that?
Okay, well, Dr. White told me if I stayed here, he would push for me to get an appointment to the medical staff
at
Children's Hospital so I could carry patients in. And whenever he said he'd do something like that, he did it. And I'm sure he worried Dean Moore to death.
Yes.
But I got a notice to come to a meeting in Dean Moore's office, which is in the old medical school building.
Right.
And when I got there, there were three other
black physicians, men.
All men. And Dr. Moore talked to us and told us we were all being given appointments to the faculty.
In 1954, this was, I do believe.
I think. And that you could now carry private patients in and treat them yourself.
And then you told me that you were introduced to the Board of Managers. I don't know
why. Dr. Hartman said he would like for the Board of Managers at Children's Hospital to see me. And it was a sort of anger-provoking thing. I mean, what did they think a black woman looked like?
Well, you know, you have to realize, again, based on my thesis, these were St. Louis society women whose knowledge of black folk was probably if they had a black maid, you know, the idea of a highly educated, sophisticated young woman. And so they brought you up and they...
So I went to the staff meeting, they had a monthly meeting, and I went to that meeting, and Dr. Hartman introduced me and told them that he knew exactly what he was doing the day I was born. He was up in the lab trying to make Ringer's lactate.
Right.
So infants wouldn't have so much diarrhea.
That's amazing. And I'm sure he must have spoken about your excellent qualifications and how you...
Well, I think he assured them that I wouldn't bite, you know.
Right. But still, you said you felt like an exotic animal, you told me.
I did.
That they were just looking at you.
I felt like they were looking at something that they had heard existed but didn't know.
Did you dress special in any way? Did you put on a white coat or?
No,
just
because I didn't wear white coats after I finished my internship.
Right. And so then you told me you would go to Grand Rounds and attend and your patients would be admitted, but didn't you tell me you weren't supposed to touch white patients?
You weren't supposed to. Until you got on the staff at Children's, you weren't supposed to bother any of the patients, black or white. And you would see those that they brought down to conference on Friday morning.
Right.
But as for going up and making rounds, it was unheard of. After my appointment, I could do that. And I would...
But you were the first black attending physician at that hospital, so it must have felt kind of lonely up there.
I like being on the spot all the time.
And Dr. White, was he a presence at Children's Hospital? Was he?
Yes.
So happy. And he was proud of you.
He was proud. And if I called him up and had to report any untoward incident, he would help me handle it.
That's great.
He was really wonderful. I guess if you're breaking into that kind of situation, you need someone like Dr. White.
You need a mentor.
Behind you.
And he did, even though he was a man of the 19th century and had his prejudices, when it came to you, he was very protective of you,
I think.
He
was very protective. He was really marvelous.
All right, I'd like to hear about the first patient you admitted.
Okay. I used to go to Kinlock to do the Well Baby Clinic.
That was a black community.
It was a black community, and there was a Well Baby Clinic out there that no one had ever really pulled together and done it well. Some women doctors had gone out there, but I didn't find anyone in the clinic whose immunizations were complete. And I found the women were not used to coming because the doctor was used to not showing up all the time. And so I started working the Well Baby Clinic in Kinlock. I would go there.
On top of your practice, you would take on extra?
Every Thursday morning.
And so your practice would be closed Thursday morning while you...
No, it would be open, and the office girl would be there, and she would be answering phone and
setting up appointments.
Telling patients what time I'd be.
But you'd be at Kinlock for the morning.
I'd be in Kinlock for the morning. It is now the airport, I think. Anyway,
amazing.
I used to make house calls on my way back into town. I got a call to make a house call on this little girl who was very sick. And she lived right around the corner from Homo Phillips Hospital. And I went and made this call. And this little girl had a high fever. She was sitting on a pot when I came in having diarrhea. And I examined her and looked at her and I said to the mother, if I only knew she went to Kenlock, I would think she has typhoid fever. The mother said, we go every week. My husband runs the movie projector out there. And they go every week. So I went over to Homer Phillips and got some stool culture material and blood drawing material and took them back to Dr. Blosch, who was in charge of the lab, and told him I needed these. I wanted to
culture the
know what the baby. I didn't want to put a first patient I put in Children's Hospital to have the wrong diagnosis.
All right. You were.
So he said, okay, he would do them overnight for me. Anyway, the cultures were positive. The blood was positive. She really had typhoid fever, poor thing.
Did she make it? Did
oh,
she?
Oh, yes, and I see her now all the time.
But you admitted her and a typhoid?
I admitted her to Children's Hospital.
Now, would she have to be completely isolated?
She was put on Butler Ward, which was the isolation unit.
And you?
And I went to see her. They didn't know how to comb her hair, you know. They,
oh, black hair,
oh,
right.
Black
it's a whole
hair,
new experience.
This. But she was into all the things that typhoid people have. They have the personality changer. They won't speak to you and they won't look at you. And she was doing all her little typhoid things. And one of the doctors, who would like to think he's a big unprejudiced doctor, wrote in my chart, it is too bad that Dr. Nash has started the chloromycetin, because now we will never know
whether she had typhoid.
Whether or not the patient had typhoid fever.
So did you write a note after that?
I just went to him and said, you know, I wouldn't be such a fool as to put a patient in the hospital for the first time and not have the diagnosis made. I thank you for writing in my chart, but don't do so anymore.
Right. That is so interesting, because one of the challenges, I think, of being a first person, whether it's Jackie Robinson or Helen Nash, is the whole issue of anger and how you deal with people who patronize you or act ugly.
Well, I think the thing that helped me with that was I knew him well enough to go straight to him and
right,
chop him.
Right. But you never raised your voice, I'm sure.
Oh, no, no.
You were
no.
just too cool to do that.
And there used to be a big reception area down in the entryway to Children's Hospital. And there was a phone there for the doctors on running out the door. You pick up a phone and see if you had any calls.
Right.
I picked it up one day, and the operator said, you will have to use the pay phone. So I said, well, shall I act ugly out here in public, or shall I go in a little closet and call her?
And strangle her, yeah.
Strangle her. Anyway, I decided I would hang up, and I went around to the doctor's coat room. And I called, picked the phone up and said, may I have an outside line? And she said, I have told you, you will have to use the payphone. And I said, I'm going to have to tell you that I am Dr. Nash and I want a goddamn line.
And you got it.
I got it.
You got it.
But I also got this woman in, she ran around to where I was, weeping and crying.
Apologize.
Don't tell on her.
Don't get me fired.
Don't get me fired. I never do it again. I said, I had an answer for you. I don't have anybody to tell on you, but I had an answer for you. Suppose I had been a little black woman whose child had just died up on the floor,
and
I was trying to call my husband. Think about it.
Yeah.
What you were doing. You were just using a useless hour of power. She said, oh, I'll never do it again.
Well, she probably never did. But the question of your, this didn't happen just early in your career. You told me that all through your career,
straight through,
in Children's Hospital, someone asked you one time if you were a baby's grandmother. Can you tell me that story?
That was out at St. John's Hospital. I was in the newborn unit, scrubbed up in cap and gown and all, getting ready to go in the newborn unit to look at a baby. And this nurse came in and said, "Oh, you're getting ready to examine your grandbaby."
Oh, how sweet.
How sweet. I said, "You know very well that I'm Dr. Nash, and I'm not examining any goddamn grandbaby."
So she
got red and left. And she came back later and said, "You know, I'm really sorry. I know very well that you are not examining a grandbaby, and that you are Dr. Nash." I said, "But you won't forget it now."
No,
you know?
I'm sure.
And next time you see a black doctor doing something, you won't do that.
Right. And one of the things that, being your friend, I have noticed is how you, as your practice became more successful, and you took part not only in Kinloch, but you were involved with the Children's Bureau, and you became a public health advocate. And I noticed that black people in St. Louis used to be, they would say, "I'm Dr. Nash's patient," like, "I won the gold medal," you know.
The red badge of courage.
Well, I think you became a kind of status symbol for the black community because they looked up to you.
They had never had a black pediatrician, and they had never, the white pediatricians in town, some did not see black children, period. Some had what they call black days.
Special hours. Because they didn't want them in the waiting room.
See black children only on special days.
Right.
And they could come to my office anytime.
Now, did you ever have white patients? And when did you?
Yes, I had white patients. And
did that start early on, or was that later when you became?
It really started early. Mm-hmm. Because a very poor, ignorant white patient is as bad off as any.
Right. So they just they wanted help.
And when you treat them, poor ignorant white patients were treated as badly as
poor
black
blacks.
So that when you treat the patient nice,
they come back. Right. So I'd like to ask you now a little bit about the civil rights movement in St. Louis and how that affected your life or your practice, and what role you played in the civil rights movement, if any. Because I know you don't think of yourself, I mean, you're practicing medicine, you're busy, but what interests me is how you gradually not only were an attending physician, but also you're on the board of the symphony, the historical society, the garden. When did suddenly you become fashionable in the sense of the white power structure seeking you out?
I don't have to look at those years to know which one.
Right. But could you feel it happening? Could you feel
I could feel it happening when my brother came here and did his residency and started practicing. He said, "Helen, it's like an open sesame. If I go in there and I say I'm Dr. Nash's sister, all the doors fall open and everybody." I said, "Well, they don't do it from me."
So I mean, you opened the doors for him.
I opened doors for other black doctors.
That's right.
I was the only pediatrician for years. At one time, there were 5 black pediatricians in town, and we were all doing well.
Right.
So that lets you know how large the black population was.
And how big the
need
was.
And how badly they wanted their own doctors.
Right. And you moved your office from Vandeventer and Finney and what?
To Sarah and Finney. Vandeventer and Finney to Sarah and Easton over that drugstore.
Uh-huh.
And I know the black doctors decided to build a building, which is the Tandy Medical Building on King's Highway.
Oh, yes.
And they did not invite me to join in with them.
So you were still being cut
and
out.
And my husband said,
Build your own
building.
So Abernathy and you built that building on North Grand.
We built the building on North Grand. We bought the land. And we built the building.
And you practiced there for 20 or more years?
I practiced there for 20-some years. And it was fun because it was new, it was clean.
And it was yours.
And it was mine.
All yours.
And the patients loved it. They said, "Oh, I just can't believe it, Dr. Nash."
And I remember the waiting room, the way you had it decorated. You had your fingerprint on everything. The photographs were your photographs. There was a special teenage examining room
right.
to put them at ease. And
well, that's where I could get rid of the mother.
Right, right. And it was really your place. Mm-hmm. And then I want to hear about your 40th anniversary and how Dr. Colton decided.
Well, Dr. Colton was really a very nice man. And a friend of mine went to him and said, I had been telling her I would be practicing 40 years, and she said, Helen, something should be done about that.
This was 1989.
Okay, and so she went to Dr. Colton, and they did something. They had a huge party. It was unbelievable.
It was called Helen Nash Day.
Right.
They had a day.
And it was on the...
A little bit more about Helen Nash Day, and you said the wonderful thing was that not only did the patients and their and your grandpatients come, but even the parents of dead patients came,
right.
Which meant that they never stopped thinking of you as their children's doctor.
Well, what I learned early was that there's a lot of anger involved about death and dying, and especially dying children. And since the mortality rate had been so high in St. Louis, a lot of people had dead children. And I think what a lot of doctors did until we start teaching them how to handle death was run
the other way.
The other way when the patient died.
And you did not ever do that?
Well, I didn't. I used to go to the house and pronounce the baby dead. Then I would go to the funeral, and I would usually send a small pot of flowers. And then I would talk to the mother afterwards. And sometimes they would call and say, can we be sure that he couldn't have lived? And I'd go over the illness with them.
So you would comfort them and educate them, and your connection with them did not end with the baby's death.
No, they always remembered me, and I still see them. You know, it's interesting how many of them I still see. And I know why they remember me. They remember me because
of the baby
who died.
Because you didn't run, mm-hmm. Right. Because I know a young couple whose baby died in Children's Hospital within the last decade, and the doctor ran, and they never got over it. They were so bitter that he was not there, was not there with them, did not pronounce
the baby.
Well,
you have to stay with them, and you have to, well, actually, some doctors may do that because they feel they may have caused the death.
Or they failed, or they...
They failed somehow. It's seen as a, perceived as a failure on their part, but it really is not. And I saw what my father comfort patients.
That's what I was going to ask
you.
And
I saw him go back to see them, and I saw patients come back with other relatives.
So he was your role model as a practitioner.
He was my real role model as a practitioner and a doctor, you know.
And he must have been so proud of you. I think.
Well, he got proud of me. He was here in town one night, and he had an emergency. And I called the doctor, and he said, bring him to the emergency room. And I was rushing up Dundle Boulevard with him, and I said, are you glad I went to med school? He said, well, I think this is paying off.
Yeah, that's great.
So
the Helen Nash Day really was a public recognition.
It was a big Helen Nash Day, and I saw patients I hadn't seen for years, and I saw parents of dead patients,
and that must have been amazing.
And that was really fulfilling because, you know, you always have the feeling that maybe you caused the death.
Or maybe they blame me. But I think it was also a chance for Dr. Colton to put his stamp of approval and to say, look, here's this woman, mm-hmm. physician, black woman physician who has done so much for this community.
For 50 years, right.
And
that was my 50 years.
So tell me, then, when did you and how did you decide to give up your practice? Was that soon
after? Well, I had asked a woman in the Children's Bureau, Dr. Maisel Williams, used to come and inspect Homer Phillips and continue the grant we had from the government. And she talked about her practice. And one year, Harry Belafonte was here in Three for the Road or something. And I took her and the other doctor who came with her, took them to dinner at the old Statler Hotel. And then we went up to the play, which was a theater on Grand. And they had such a good time, and we laughed and talked. And I said, how did you know to stop practicing? She said, you will know it when it comes. And what happens is you start finding yourself getting irritable with patients, the parent and the patient. And I said, this has got to be the beginning of the end.
So what year did you actually close your practice? Do you remember? 92 or...
I don't remember, but I can tell you.
Right. And so...
And I said, this is it. I'm going to...
Do something else.
Jerk a baby off the table.
Right. You don't want to do that.
The
last thing I'd like to ask you about is your career in the Minority Affairs Office, because I think you brought a new style of administration. The Minority Affairs Office had been started in the late 60s and had been run for many years by a man who was not a physician and who did not have the understanding that you did of what it took to be a doctor. And I'd just like to ask you to tell me a little bit about how you changed that office in your, was it 2 years as acting head or 3 years?
Two or three.
Right.
Well, Ed Dotson, who runs admitting, was a friend of mine. And when I was on some committee of children's, but we appointed him head of the child abuse thing.
Right. A booby prize, I'm sure.
The booby prize. And he said, when he asked me to take this job.
To fill in.
To fill in until they could find a successor for Dr.
Lee.
And I said, why me? And he says, just pediatrics, Helen. You'll find it's nothing but pediatrics. and you can do it.
Right.
And so I went and I did it. And I enjoyed it. But he would laugh and say, I got you, didn't I? I got you.
But your approach was different from Dr. Lee's because of your training and
experience.
Well,
you know, they came here with expectations of failure and expectations that they were not good enough or that their application had not been sent back early because they were black. And the real trouble, they didn't send it in till late. And then you had to rush to get them back out.
Right.
And so I would tell the kids that. And I told them 1 year, there wasn't anybody in the class, any black person in the class, who should be in the lower
half, that they could all
the lower third of the class. There wasn't anybody black in there who should be in the lower third. And why you all are turning up in the lower third, I do not know.
But you also...
They're surprised, you know.
Well, I think if they have a low self-image and they think it's affirmative action and they don't deserve to be here... But there is also the point that you raised with me in a private conversation that you did raise the bar for black. In other words, you were not prepared to admit students just because they were black and wanted to come.
Oh, no, and Ed was not either, you know. He would say, this kid will get ground up here. Don't
lie. And tell me the story about Dr. Schwartz and the CARP committee, because that's a very...
Oh, I was on the CARP committee before I... was on Ed's committee, the admitting committee.
And this is the committee that said why people weren't making it, basically.
It's all people who were complaining about their expulsion because they had failed to make it academically. And we saw a patient, a student this year, and for the life of me, I read the chart, I did everything, I went to all the meetings, I said, what was she doing in here?
Right,
and Dr. Henry Swartz said, you're on the wrong end of the pipeline. Get on the other end.
And so you got on the other end.
I got on the other end, though Ed didn't know he had said that to me.
Right.
And I think that with Ed's help, we stopped admitting students who really couldn't make it here.
Right.
Because it's a high-ranking med school, and the classes are fast, they're high.
And it has to be people who can
make
it.
You have to be able to keep up.
And then you told me about an incident where they had a special invitation for black students to go to some gathering, and you stepped in and said, invite them all together. This is just another kind of segregation. Isn't that right?
Well, what I was speaking of was at the end of the year, there is a banquet, and they invite all the students who have helped with the admission priests in the admission office and in the different things and helping, showing students around the school when they come to visit and that kind of thing. And this student who has graduated came in my office and shut the door and said, there is a banquet tonight for black honor students, and none of the blacks are invited. I said, that can't be, because there are black honor students. He said, no, none of us are invited. He was one of them.
And I said, okay, I'll try to take care of that. And I spoke to Ed about it, and I asked him, did he mind if I did something about it? He said, go get them.
Go do it. And you did.
I did it, and they got invited. I was told that maybe they would be insulted. I said, if they will be insulted, let them throw the invitation back, but at least invite them.
And they came.
Not only came, but were grateful.
They were glad.
And they were glad. And I don't think they've been left out of much
since then.
Since that time.
But I think that's just another example of how you how your influence changed.
I think that if you come from a place that has always treated black people as different or lower than
right.
or not equal to, you will continue to do it.
It's just the normal thing to
do. It's
the
normal way to behave. And,
right.
and until people stop you, you don't do
it. It'll just go on.
It goes on.
And then I remember when I taught the class on gender and race, and we had some young black women who felt they were being treated more harshly or unfairly. I can remember you saying to them, you are so lucky to be in this medical school. And you gave me the impression that you really felt that black medical schools were obsolete, that Meharry and...
Well, I thought they should be closed. They said, what do you think should be done? I think they should be closed. I think we should not have an all-black medical school anymore. Actually, Meharry and Howard are not all-black anymore. They have a big mixture.
Of white and
white,
Asian.
Indian, and Asian, whatever.
So that has changed.
And that has changed, but I didn't have anything to do with it.
But if you were a young, smart black woman starting out today, you would not go
to the Northeast.
Right. You would not be going to Meharry or
I would not go to Meharry or Howard.
That's really interesting. Now Dr. Nash is going to speak about how women were treated when she went to Meharry in 1942.
We were treated as anomalies.
Like you were strange.
We came to play. We didn't really plan to study. We planned to do what they used to say, ride through on someone's coattails. And
get married and...
whatever, but
yeah, you were
get
not,
through some kind of way, not necessarily with having to do with having studied, worked hard, and earned your grades. So there were four women in my med school class, and actually three of us
ended up at Homer Phillips, or
we ended up at Homer Phillips, but we actually rode through on our own
coattails,
not anyone else's.
Did you have a study group where you got together?
No, we didn't have a study group. I've never done well in study groups, and I didn't go to one.
So you studied by yourself?
My roommate and I. She was sophomore and I was freshman.
Margaret.
Yeah.
So would you, when you got to Homer Phillips, was there a esprit de corps among the women interns? Did they?
No.
No. Everybody was just trying to survive the best way they could.
Surviving.
And 4 out of 60, that's a very small, that's less than 10%. So you were a minority within.
You've seen that picture of the.
Yes, and you were pretty.
And three of those women are dead.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, the stress, I mean, that's another issue I'd like to speak to you about, is the stress of being a minority physician and a minority physician within a minority, which is to say a black woman, where the male black medical community did not treat you right either.
Well, what I think helped me the most in that was my father.
Yes.
Who said, no matter what anybody says, you can do it.
So your father's voice would ring in your ears even now. Even now you
can
probably
do it, you know. Yeah. And my niece came to me and said, years ago, said, Helen, I'm going to be a doctor just like you.
This is Dr. Allison Nash.
Right. And I said, if so, you're going to have to fight Dr. Homer Nash.
And she did?
Well, she joined the Navy and paid her own tuition.
That is wonderful. So that tradition of female independence goes on
it's
in your
inherited.
Family. There must be a gene for that.
Maybe.
That's great. Now we're going to talk about the medical school and Dr. White, as Dr. Nash saw them both.
Well, he was as much in my corner all my career as my father was. And he was glad to have someone who would help fight racial issues with him.
And plus, you were a living example of what he
did. And
believed.
I was proof that a black woman could do it, you know. One day, a woman came in my office with a beautiful little girl. She had on a pink dress with ruffles, and she had long black curls, and the thing that amazed me when they came into the examining room is she stood in the corner screaming. And the mother said, she's deaf, she can't hear you, and she can't talk. And I've done everything. She had written to Spencer Tracy's wife. She had written everywhere.
This was a black child?
Mm-hmm. She had been out here deviling them to death, and they would not take a black child.
So Central Institute was segregated?
Central Institute was horribly segregated. And I didn't find out how badly segregated it was until I was at the airport one day. And here were all these dark-skinned South American children who were deaf being taken home by Central Institute students, and much darker than the black child I wanted in.
Right.
And so I got really angry, and I called Dr. White, and I said, something should be done. You know, no black kids can go to Central Institute. Their parents live in this city. They pay taxes in this city. And they should be allowed to attend Central Institute. He knew Dr. Lane, who was the principal then. He was on the board at Central Institute. And I called it to his attention. They don't
let black...
They're tax-free, and black parents are paying taxes here, and these deaf children, and they don't see any deaf children, yet they will take a jet black child from South America and put him in the school.
Bizarre. Yeah.
Bizarre.
And this would have been in the 50s that you were speaking of.
I can tell you the exact year.
Right. And you helped change the policy then?
I said... He went to the board. He was on the board.
Dr. White went to the board.
Dr. Lane was the principal. And we got Sheila in the school. And it was a sort of sliding in catacorner way, because the mother was very bright and had her degree. She had finished college. And they decided she could come to Central Institute as a student, and she would have to work on her child. Couldn't touch the white children.
But the child did get in and did.
But she got in, and Mrs. Hope became invaluable to them.
Isn't that wonderful?
And I think she's still teaching at Gwaldet. She may have retired now.
That's amazing.
But she taught at Gwaldet, and
so
Sheila finished high school.
That's great. So there were many intricate aspects of racism, from bananas and ice cream to the CID.
To Central Institute. And the thing that was lovely about Dr. Lane was I was speaking at a church one year, and she was there, and I was saying instances of horrible prejudice and segregation, and I talked about Central Institute, and she said, and I was the principal, and I want you to know that is really true. She and Dr. White did do that.
Made a difference. So you and Dr. White must have been a real good team.
Well, I would find them out,
and then he would
get them.
Right.
Anyway, then Dr. Gladden's wife went to the school, and she taught, and they started training black teachers.
That's great.
And then they started admitting black students. I hope they're still doing so.
Oh, I'm sure they are. So we're talking about all these issues on top of you're running a practice,
mm-hmm.
you're attending.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you start teaching medical students? Was that part of being an attending?
I did that from the beginning.
When you were attending, you would teach.
When you were attending, you taught, because you had to go to clinic, and you got clinic patients, and you taught them.
But didn't Dr. Colton want you to teach a course in adolescent medicine? Is that not correct?
No. I don't think that's correct.
No.
He was a good man, and he was really kind to me.
And I want to hear about, I guess what I'd like is to go through the heads of pediatrics that you knew personally, beginning with Dr. Hartman, whom we know was not racially enlightened, but he did give you a chance. I mean, he put you on staff anyway.
Right.
And then Dr. Dodge came in 67, and he was a good person, I hope. Okay. But Dr. Colton was really...
Dr. Colton was really...
The one who made a difference.
The one who made a difference.
Then you were elected president of the staff.
Staff Society.
And that must have... I don't know whether that was...
Well, as Dr. White said, I said, oh, Dr. Hartman should see me now. And Dr. White said his wife would bust a gut.
Yeah, that's right. So Dr. White lived to see you be president of the...
the staff society.
And that must have been just great.
It was really funny, especially when he told me, Dr. Harmon wouldn't mind seeing you now,
it's his
but
wife.
His wife would bust the gut. Yes. Which meant to me she had probably persuaded him not to take black interns, and that had reinforced him. You know?
Right, right.
But he was a sort of gentle man. He's not like his son at all.
No. But so Dr. White was someone who was your, like your father, your mentor, someone you could trust. Mm-hmm. Did your father and Dr. White meet?
Oh, yes.
And they got along?
And Dr. White, they got along, and we went out there to dinner, and they came over to my house to dinner. And Dr. White loved to find people who couldn't re-quote Shakespeare to him.
And then he
would
do it.
Or the Bible. And he found his match in Dr. Homer Nash.
They could quote back and forth.
No matter what he said, Dr. Homer Nash would get him. I've never met anybody
that.
Like
must have been just wonderful.
I've never met anybody like your father, Helen. I said, well, he's different.
He really was. And I remember you told me one time how sometimes people assume because you're a black physician that you had to crawl out of the ghetto, and they don't really understand that Atlanta was a
you never
town,
lived in the ghetto.
Right. In your family's milieu, education was a normal given of your life.
My grandfather sent all of his children off to northern colleges. His son went to Howard, his daughter went to Oberlin, one aunt went to Fisk, and because those three didn't do as well as he wanted them to, he sent my mother to Atlanta University.
That's great.
She said, why didn't you send me off to school, Pop? He said, because the others were crazy.
Oh, that's funny. That is amazing.
But she would have made it wherever he sent her.
She was smart.
She was a music teacher. Yeah. My aunt went to Oberlin.
Right. So music has always been important in
music
your life.
Music has been important in the family.
And in your life, too.
And in my life, yes. Right. I couldn't do without the symphony.
I'm going to quote you on that. Whenever you tell me you're going to give it up, I'm going to play this back.
Clinics opened after the war, and they were a memorial to David P. Wold, their son, who had been killed in the war.
And they opened up well baby clinics.
They opened up health clinics all over the city, and you could hold the well baby clinic, and there are lots of different clinics would meet. One was at Kings Highway and Eastern Avenue.
And
that's
the
one I worked. I had been working the Laclede Clinic, which was way downtown on Laclede.
And you found that the white doctor was...
And when we got out there that day, and they start sending patients, I was getting all the patients, and Dr. Blyer was sitting there with no patients.
Because they were all the black patients.
They were sending me the blacks and him the whites.
The three white patients, or
three
whatever.
White, whatever. And I said to the nurse, Miss Liddy, what is happening here? She said, we have to send the white patients to
Dr. Blyer,
and you get the rest. I said, well, I'm not going to see all of the patients he's been seeing, so don't send them in my room. I'm not going to do it. And I'm going to tell.
So did you call Dr. White?
Called Dr. White right away, who had called Melvin Tess. Dr. Melvin Tess was a health commissioner, I think. And Dr. Tess told everybody that I thought I could make him let me see white patients. I didn't care what color they were.
You just wanted a fair division of labor.
I wanted them to be divided up equally, and I wanted... You would only make patients think something is wrong with them if they could only see a black doctor, or these over here can only see a white doctor. So, Dr. Tess was really angry with me. He said, Helen Nash thinks she can make me...
Troublemaker.
So I said, I don't think I can make him do anything. I just know that he's going to have to come out there and see those that I don't see, because I'm not going to see all. It was 90% black.
Right. So you would see 50 patients and Dr. Blyer would see four or three.
Three or four.
So you got that straightened out.
I mean, they were nonsensical things, you know. We straightened. That got straight, and then you...
Then there'd be something else you'd find out, maybe.
Trying out there doing something else and saying, I'm not going to do that. Say, Helen Nash is crazy.
So when Homer Phillips closed, were you glad it closed? Did you?
Oh, yes, I think it should be closing. And I hate to say it, but I think the building needs to come down because it doesn't have any plumbing.
Right.
And there could be something else put there that would memorialize Homer Phillips. He was
what it stood for.
An important person and what it stood
right.
for.
But basically, you don't think that regional hospital is a good idea either. It's the same idea.
Well, it's too small. The patient's load is going to shake it down. You know, that's a very fragile building there.
The old St. Luke's Hospital. So the problems you saw when you started out in medicine in St. Louis of infectious disease, infant mortality. Now, even now, the black infant mortality rate is still double that of whites.
Yeah, but black people don't take as good a care because they can't afford the care. And there are some things that are not open, not by racial segregation, but by
economic,
financial
right.
and economics.
So just not having the means to pay.
Not having the means to pay. For example, the little girl I saw with typhoid fever when I first started practicing, I mean, she could have gotten treated at Homer Phillips, but she belonged in the isolation ward at Children's Hospital with her typhoid fever, where she would get everything she needed.
Right. And you got her, and she was your first
admission.
My
parents are still alive, and I see them at the grove. We wave, and I see her, and it's really fun.
That is great. I think that's a very good note to end on. That's wonderful.
Okay.
So your career has come full circle, and you're still in touch with your original patients.
I see a lot of them there at the grocery store, there at the symphony, there.